Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stephen. Nice to be here.
Sydney has experienced rapid change over the last 50 years. So having first encountered the city in the 70s, how do you think that it has shifted in character over the decades?
Oh, look, a lot of people say to me, Sydney was really great in the 50s. And I think, well, I wasn't here, didn't know it. So I know that it's dangerous to complain about, you know, cities changing over time. Mm. And I like change, broadly speaking, because I'm an architect and architects are trained, of course, to enjoy being creative and making new things. So that's kind of the background. But it seems to me that a lot of what's happened in Sydney over that time is regrettable, especially recently, like really recently. In the 70s, I came here as a student just briefly and visited and just absolutely fell in love with, you know, the place and the topography and the funny little buildings and the ridiculous narrow streets and the glorious air and the climate, you know, everything about it just seemed terribly thrilling to me. And particularly the kind of sense of energy, of interesting, creative, small-scale energy, but doing collective things. And I thought that was really cool. I had no idea cities could be so much fun, actually. And of course, there's partly part of that's being young, I expect. And one of the things I've always loved about Sydney was that it didn't go for all that kind of inner city motorways, destroying itself for, you know, high-rise buildings everywhere thing. And it basically kept itself fairly intact, although with some significant losses, up until about 10 years ago. And then there's just been this huge development boom. And as you say, a whole lot of sameness and boringness and hugeness and kind of soullessness has kicked in.
In your book, you describe in detail the great importance of a city as a sort of form of social connection, a sort of agglomeration of old and new. Yet we're increasingly seeing how constructions in the inner city have started to become increasingly from the one-size-fits-all model. In your book, you talk about the sort of deregulation mindset that's driving a lot of the creativity in the built environment. Would you say this has been pivotal in what some of the changes that are happening within the inner city?
I actually think that planners have kind of forgotten the essential theories behind planning and the purpose of planning, which is essentially to protect the public interest. But overriding all of that, and much more dangerous, I think, is this government sensibility that says the private sector is always right and the public sector knows nothing. And so they outsource everything and they sell everything off to the private sector. And this is almost like a government envy of the business model. And that in city making, that reflects in this kind of abandonment of control and a tendency just to get huge development sites like all the big old industrial sites or like public land where it's even worse, like Barangaroo. And instead of saying, so this is what you're allowed to do and this is the way you can do it and we'll parcel it up and we'll do the streets and plant the trees and then you can build within those parameters, they just tend to say to one big developer, how much money can you give us and do whatever you like? And I think that's disastrous because it means that no one's actually looking after the public interest and the private interest is the only one that gains out of it.
Now, in your book, you talk about a collapse of this sense of public space. Space is increasingly becoming privatised, leading to this focus on efficiency and concerns about congestion. How much of this is the result of the governance of our planning institutions in the way in which they interact with the community to make what they assume is representing our interests?
Well, I think notoriously our governments don't interact with communities, and that's a part of the problem. It's not the whole of the problem. There are other problems as well. But there's a sort of pretense at consultation. And virtually all communities you speak to now have become incredibly jaded and cynical and quite depressed and sort of despairing because they feel unheard. And it's almost like living in communist China or something. That there's a sense that there's a charade going on where the government pretends to ask for the public views on what they want and how they'd like to see things developed. And the public goes along in good faith and sort of says all this stuff and puts in all this time and does kind of charrettes and workshops and, you know, all that sort of thing. And then nothing changes. And then the developer just does what they were going to do anyway. And everything's horrid. And so you have these clumps of high-rise towers just about every suburb from Wallye Creek, Bondi Junction, Tempe, Marrickville, out to Bankstown, Liverpool. Everywhere you go, there are these great sort of routings of sort of 40-story towers, which are not just high-rise, but they're high-rise with really awful implications for the street because they're terribly close together and they create huge wind conditions at street level and the streets are kind of miserable and there's no heritage left and trees are chopped down. And it's just this kind of awful, dead environment that's produced. And And it's all the same. It's kind of just out of the developer's patent book, you know, whatever's cheapest. So it's just, it's depressing. It's a loss.
It sort of reminds me a bit of that, sort of what I call the faux connection that I see, like with urban growth. I'm in Parramatta area, and when they have discussions there, one poor like guy in his early 20s will appear. Obviously, doesn't know a huge amount about the issue, and basically almost there is a punching bag for all the complaints. And you know that the people actually involved in the decision making are not actually present and
not there. Yes, not, there's a sacrificial lamb.
The consultation is more on a cosmetic value rather than an actual sort of interactive process.
So. And once the community starts to understand that it's really just a charade, then it just, that's when they really get frustrated and annoyed and angry about it. And Parramatta is a really good case, actually, because I was out at Parramatta again the other day thinking with a friend, we had thought we'd go and have a look at Parramatta and talk about the transport system. And I got out of the train and thought, oh my God, this is what's happened to Parramatta Square. Look at this. This is public land. How dare they do this and call it a civic space? It's an absolute disgrace. I was so shocked.
Well, over the last 5 years, Parramatta has, it's had its council abolished by the administrator. It's had its pool demolished to increase the football stadium. And now we've got a whole range of historical buildings from the arrival of the First Fleet. The actual heritage value of them
is basically a lovely town. I mean, that town centre of Parramatta, we can call it a city, but it's got that lovely little central grid, which is just kind of tucked in between a railway line on one side and a river on the other side. Two beautiful, simple transport modes, and the high street, Church Street, stretched between with the church and the what should be a civic square and stuff. And, you know, it's got really good bones and it should be lovely. And it's got beautiful Parramatta Park, which keeps being depraved by football stadium. And it's got beautiful Cumberland Precinct, you know, where the light rail's going tearing right through the middle of the Heritage Precinct as we speak. But it's got so much potential. And I think it's really being misunderstood and badly treated by government in particular, by its own government and the council.
So over the last decade, we've seen many historical buildings suborned for private usage. Yeah, at the moment, there's a perception that people, as you mentioned, locked out of the decision-making process. Now, if you go back to, like, what Pat Fisk's documentary, Rocking the Foundations, it's actually shown where there has actually been the potential for public to actually gain greater involvement in the decisions that are affecting their environment. Can you see a sort of similar movement happening again in Sydney?
Look, I hope so. I believe people are starting to be really concerned. I feel as though, you know, I published a little thing in the paper the other day, which was called A Citizen's Manifesto, which was kind of, you know, get annoyed, get motivated. Because people are always writing to me saying, I really love Sydney. I'm really concerned about what's happened to it. So many things are being destroyed and lost. We're being locked out of the process. What can I do? How can I be involved? And so I think it will change. Then we will start to make ourselves heard again and make ourselves felt. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, there were huge protests. There were green bans, of course, and there were street protests about saving heritage in particular. I know that people love Sydney. As we start to live more locally, because I think COVID's forcing that and various other trends, and that means that you tend to walk around more and you tend to be more engaged with your neighbourhood, and that means that you value it more. So I suspect that'll translate into more energy in the kind of popular movement to defend and look after this place, not just as a way for rich people to make a lot of money, but also for people to live and to work in and to play in and to bring up children and to enjoy. And that's really important. And we sort of forget that it matters.